Hello and welcome to this new episode of the Political People podcast. We really hope you enjoy. If you do, please subscribe and leave us a review. It'd be much appreciated. You can check out our Twitter at political_PPL and also our Facebook, Political People Blog. This podcast is, of course, brought to you by the staff from Political People Blog. Today we're joined by Dr. Jill Stein, who is running for president under a Green Party banner. Jill in the past has run for president in 2012 and managed to receive over 450,000 votes and also ran for governor. She is, you could say, a progressive idol and believes in many of the things which we believe in here at Political People Blog. Therefore, we were really delighted to have the opportunity to discuss issues such as foreign policy, economic inequality, the Democratic primary race, and also the future of green politics. Thank you very much for listening. What are the main issues that you intend to base your campaign on?
So, you know, an overall summary is that we want to end the crisis of economic inequality, climate catastrophe, endless wars for oil, and student debt and the enslavement of a generation. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the big picture. The core of our campaign is a Green New Deal, that is declaring an emergency of our economy and of our climate and creating an emergency program to meet the degree of this crisis, to really meet it with a solution that's as big as the crisis that's barreling down on us. We call for emergency creation of 20 million living wage jobs that transition us to a green economy, a green energy, food, and transportation system, and restoring critical infrastructure, including ecosystems. And we're calling for this in the time frame that's needed. So we want to have 100% renewable energy by 2030 in time to actually solve this crisis. Doing so revives our economy, it turns the tide on climate change, and it makes wars for oil obsolete. And the final wonderful thing about this is that it pays for itself just in terms of health savings alone. Because when you shut down the endless stream of pollution into our air, our water, our consumer products, etc., that derive from fossil fuels, we get so much healthier that it massively reduces our healthcare costs. And this is not just a hypothetical. This actually happened in the country of Cuba when their oil pipeline went down. So we know this is really true. When you take the pollution out of the air, you enable people to eat a fresh and healthy, sustainable food system, and you integrate public transportation into walking and biking so we can actually use our own motor power to get places. That creates the real foundation for health that we in this country spend $3 trillion a year for, and we are only getting sicker, we're not getting better. So we can massively undercut our costs, not only in this sick care system, but also our military costs, which is another disaster that we can talk about, which is robbing us blind, and instead put those dollars into true security here at home, and actually for the rest of the world too, through a Green New Deal.
I asked that question as during the 2015 UK election, the Green Party significantly increased their share of the vote by becoming a party that addressed a wide variety of issues, such as the ones that you have just mentioned, the exacerbation of income inequality, the privatisation of National Health Service in the UK, zero-error contracts, when previously they had just been perceived as a party that discussed climate and green issues. Have you looked at other Green parties internationally to see what issues work and connect with voters?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I was in Paris, excuse me, for the climate summit in December, and had a chance to meet with many Greens, including Caroline Lucas from the UK, the Green parliamentarian, and Greens actually from all over the world, from as far as Southeast Asia and Lebanon, and then many European Greens. And it was fascinating. I was really surprised how far the Green Party has moved. I think the UK really represents where the new Green Party is going. In many ways, the Green Party emerged out of Germany as a response to Chernobyl and the crisis in nuclear energy. But the Green Party has really grown from there. So while Germany remains a real leader among the Green parties in green energy, the other Green parties have really are leading the charge on a more globalized agenda of justice. So we've always been talking about climate justice and environmental justice, but I think Greens have realized that you cannot achieve environmental justice unless you also have social and economic and labor and racial justice and immigrant justice. They must all go together. And the minute we put them together, we are an unstoppable political force.
As you just mentioned, the Green Party for quite some time now have deeply cared about the issue of economic inequality long before the Democrats latched onto it. However, people have become accustomed to politicians merely mentioning income inequality as a way of getting votes rather than offering credible solutions. According to recent research, the world's richest 1% will own more than all the rest by next year. What simple steps would you take to attack inequality at its roots?
Great question. And it's really critical. Another companion statistic I'll just mention is that 62 of the world's richest billionaires now have the equivalent of the wealth of the lower half of the world's population, 3.5 billion people. And this is increasing. It's not decreasing. This is the result of the neoliberal agenda that has really seized hold not only in the United States but in governments all over the world to our peril. And it's very important that we have a system change to a system that puts people, planet, and peace over profit, instead of putting profit over all else, which is what we have right now. So I'm going to mention a couple of things, and this drives towards a transition in power, which is critical because the current political parties in the U.S. and elsewhere, many places, but speaking specifically about the U.S., we have political parties that are funded by predatory banks, by fossil fuel giants, and by war profiteers. And that drives, you know, the agenda of the U.S., which has been so devastating not only to the U.S. economy, but to the economy and the people all over the world. So it's very important. Our core policy is this Green New Deal, which basically prioritizes jobs and ensures that there is the funding for local communities to create the jobs that they need to make themselves sustainable economically, socially, and ecologically. And that's where we create these jobs that are primarily focused on clean energy, on sustainable food and public transportation and ecosystem restoration. But we include in that housing, schools, healthcare facilities, etc., the things that meet our needs socially. That's the bottom line for the Green New Deal, is making our communities sustainable. That funding is not available to large corporations. It's to community-based small businesses, and to community-based worker cooperatives and government jobs, so that we basically create a new economy that restores our environment and our food system as we go along. We call for a new financial system as well. We call for nationalizing the Fed, not just auditing the Fed, which the Sanders campaign is very right to call for, but we'd like to go beyond that. We'd like to go beyond breaking up the big banks, which again, the Sanders campaign rightfully calls for. But if you break up banks and leave slightly less big predatory banks, we still have a problem. We need public banks that basically loan out money to those who need it, and which can drastically then undercut the costs of public works by as much as 50%. Because the loans are basically structured so that everyday people and public interest groups can use them and can pay them back without having to deal with predatory interest rates. Those are some of the key strategies. And let me just also say that in the Green New Deal, we shoot for 100% clean renewable energy. And we would support that as a global target. We would like to defund the military, cut the military by at least 50%, which is the companion to the Green New Deal, because you don't need the wars. Instead, you can put that money where you actually need it. And we would support all countries actually cutting their military budgets and enabling all of us to put that money into an emergency green transition. The U.S., regrettably, in the words of Martin Luther King, has been the greatest purveyor of violence worldwide. That was true in his day. It's even more true now. And by demilitarizing our foreign policy and creating a foreign policy based on international law, human rights, and diplomacy, you know, we help enable a transition around the world and need to begin talking with other world, other countries around the world as a member of the world community, not as a power seeking to dominate militarily and economically.
I'd just like to expand upon the issue which you have shown an undoubtable refreshing sense of leadership on, which is foreign policy. You've come out for cuts to the national defense budget, which of the fiscal year 2016 is projected to be $585 billion. I don't think anybody supports the unnecessary interventionism which has been perpetuated by members of both parties. And with that in mind, what is the ideal level of defense spending in your mind? And also, how do you typically address a common worry for average Americans, which is that if you implement cuts to the national defense budget, they feel it has a direct impact on the actual safety of the U.S.
Exactly. So let me address that question first, because you know, it's very hard for people to listen to a proposal or a plan for reducing the military budget while they feel like their lives are at risk. And currently, American fears are being so whipped up into a frenzy by this endless stream of propaganda. So it's not only the election dialogue and the and the absolute fear campaigning going on the part of the Republicans, but the Democrats buy into that as well, I must say, and into this concept that we have to fight ISIS with more of what created ISIS and just, you know, further fan the flames of terrorism. It's hard for people to listen to a solution until they understand how we can really conquer terrorism. And so let me address that first. And that is that we can actually put a halt to these wars for oil, and we can stop ISIS in its tracks, ISIS and other terrorist groups. Let's look at the context of this first. We have spent $6 trillion over the last 15 years. We have allowed tens of thousands of Americans to be killed and maimed. And in turn, we have killed over a million people, mostly civilians, in Iraq alone. And what has this produced? You know, we pulled out all the stops in this fight against terrorism following 9/11. We pulled out all the stops, every resource that we could possibly mobilize, we did. And what did we achieve with this? Let's be clear. We've created failed states in Iraq, Libya, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen. Our policy has not helped. It has only made matters worse. So we have allowed governments to be destroyed. We've created breeding grounds for terrorism, which is actually much bigger now than it was before this all started. We have globalized Al-Qaeda. Taliban has much more territory than they did before. And ISIS was created out of the chaos we brought to Iraq. So, you know, and it doesn't stop there. We've also created a refugee crisis, which is tearing Europe apart at the seams now. And, you know, that refugee crisis included 60 million people last year, largely as a consequence of the economic and military policies that the U.S. is inflicting around the world, along with our allies. But we are certainly leading the charge. So this is not a policy that's working. And let's be clear, it is actually horrifically, catastrophically counterproductive. This has been throwing gasoline on the fires. Let's go back to where terrorism, really international terrorism, religious terrorism, first reared its head, and that was in Afghanistan. And remember, this was being funded and armed by the United States and by Saudi Arabia as a policy of basically making trouble for the Russians in Afghanistan, which we were intervening in as well. The Russians saw themselves as intervening against us. We were intervening against them. And we then whipped up this global jihadi movement, allowing the Saudis to use their own homegrown prototype, which was really the driving force in global jihad, and that's what's called Wahhabism, which is a very extreme form of religious violence, which has been the prototype. And the Saudis have continued funding and arming terrorism while we arm the Saudis. We have an open spigot on arms, $100 billion in the last 5 years alone. Some say 100, some say 50. But whatever it is, it's a huge amount of weapons we've been pouring into the Saudis, who in turn are shipping it basically everywhere. It's not only the Saudis, it's also the Qataris. And Turkey have played a leading role here too. So the bottom line is that the U.S. and its allies actually have control over the vast majority of the weapons and the funding for the terrorist forces. Now, that's not to say that the Saudis are necessarily funding ISIS right now. Instead, they're funding, you know, the Al-Nusra Fund and Al-Qaeda and others that they want to call good terrorists and we want to call good terrorists. The bottom line here is that what we call terrorism is a constantly shifting hybrid of resistance fighters who don't, you know, who are responding to occupation and to the terror of bombs and drones being dropped on their heads, the raids in the middle of the night. So these are resistance fighters, these are warlords and thugs, and these are religious jihadists. So it's not like you can fund some of them or train some of them, which again has been U.S. policy, not only in, you know, in Syria and Iraq, but in Afghanistan. You know, it's been the warlord du jour that we ally with, who then turns around and then suddenly becomes the best friend of Al-Qaeda or ISIS. So we need an arms embargo. That's the bottom line here. We need an arms embargo. The U.S. is supplying way more arms around the world than any other provider, and particularly to the Middle East. So we can single-handedly begin this arms embargo to the Middle East and begin to engage not only our allies, but the Russians and the Iranians and so on, who are all really going down in this quagmire that's extremely threatening to all of us right now. So it's a weapons embargo. It's shutting down the funding. After 9/11, it was known that the Saudis were the major funders of 9/11, and we have been supposedly telling them to clean up their act, which they have not done. In Secretary Clinton's WikiLeaks State Department cables that were released approximately 2012, I think these were written, even then she was acknowledging that the Saudis were the major funders of terrorism and global jihad. So the Saudis have not cleaned up their act. This is not the time to turn the Saudis loose and tell them to get their hands dirty. Unfortunately, they have been leading the charge here in global terrorism. So this is the time to begin impounding the funds of the countries, actually seizing the bank accounts of those countries who are the driving force behind international terror. So we have the power to actually shut down ISIS by shutting down its weapons, shutting down its funding, insisting that the Turks close their border to the movement of militias across that border to support ISIS, and insisting that the sale of ISIS's illegal oil on the black market also stop. So we can stop ISIS in its tracks by depriving it of the oxygen that it needs in order to survive. And in that light, we need to move ahead with negotiations, including all parties, to begin allowing democracy and local governance to actually take place by stopping this hail, this incessant storm of fire and destruction that's raining down on these countries.
What you're saying is absolutely correct, but do you ever worry that the complex multi-dimensional nature of your foreign policy approach won't be appealing to the American public, because currently we see candidates such as Donald Trump and Ted Cruz offering a simple kind of let's bomb them, let's carpet bomb them approach. And it seems to appeal to a certain type of voter. Do you ever worry that your foreign policy is just too complex, too great to be bought into?
Well, you know, I don't, because it takes a vacuum, you know, for people to be forced into sort of fascist ideals. In many ways, this is a response to what happened when, you know, people came to the Obama election with so much hope. You know, hope and change was what it was all about. He had an enormous mandate. He had two Democratic houses of Congress, yet he went to work for Wall Street, basically, and bailed them out, you know, like they've never seen before, and really threw the average worker under the bus, you know, has been pushing free trade agreements, etc. So the average American has really had a very hard time and was betrayed. So that's when the houses of Congress began to flip and went over, you know, from blue to red. We see this happening in state after state, that it's the, you know, it's the desolation of the economy. It's the abandonment of the American worker in any sense of justice in this country that has really forced people, you know, into this little fascist pigeonhole. So it's very important that we disrupt that right away. I think, you know, the story of peace alone does not address this. This has to go hand in hand with the certainty that people are going to have jobs, they're going to have good wages, they're going to have health care, we're going to get young people out of debt. You know, it's that economic program that allows people to relax so they, you know, don't feel like they have to beat up on immigrants in order to have a job. We need to address those fears where they're coming from, and people need a right to hear where it is that terrorism has gotten its power. And you can simplify it, you know, down to that, you know, that the Saudis with American backing got this whole thing going. Violence is creating more and more violence. People get this war is expensive. It has cost $75,000 per household over the last 16 years when you divide up $6 trillion. So that fact alone is very motivating to people. They don't need these friggin' wars for oil. You hear a lot of objections to that in the street. And the minute we begin to combat on the public airwaves this incessant propaganda campaign, and to let people know that there is a way forward based on just plain old human rights, human dignity, common good, that's easy for people to understand. And I think by shutting it down, we force people into the camp of fascism.
I want to talk a bit about the media with you. How is it that a vibrant, innovative, progressive campaign such as the one that you are running doesn't get covered that much by MSNBC, CNN, Fox, etc.? There are some, I suppose, that would say there's a conspiracy against candidates who advocate for change, while others would attribute the lack of coverage surrounding campaigns such as yours to more innocent factors such as ratings. What's your thought on the issue?
Well, the media has been corporatized, you know, over the last decade or two, and it only gets worse. You know, it gets more and more consolidated. And as that happened, you saw reporters having a really hard time trying to cover third party and opposition politics. And after a while, it becomes a very self-selecting process. I mean, I myself have seen reporters lose their jobs and get transferred out of, you know, good jobs because they covered our campaign. And, you know, there is definitely a climate of censorship, whether it's active censorship or it's self-censorship. People understand that there is a there's an agenda that needs to be supported, and you cannot, as reporters, they take their careers in their hands by allowing an agenda to surface that sort of threatens the corporate power that their employers are a part of. You know, these big media conglomerates that are very much a part of the corporate power structure. So they just don't cover it. And we have a nickname for the press. We call them the O-Press and the Repress, because that's their job these days. But that doesn't mean we can't mobilize, because we have seen social movements do very amazing and powerful things without a shred of corporate coverage. And that includes, we stopped the first Syrian war. You may recall in 20... 13, there was an effort to begin a bombing campaign based on what now looks like it was a false flag chemical weapons attack in Syria. That was stopped in its tracks by a groundswell of grassroots opposition. Same thing, you know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We have been able to delay that until now. It's in an election year, and there is, yeah, it got signed, but that was only a symbolic signing. It's got to get passed in Congress, and we'll be holding their feet to the fire and working to stop it. We have succeeded in stopping prior trade agreements, and the internet has been saved twice. Once from Congress and the other time from the Federal Communications Commission. We were able to save a public internet by mobilizing largely through the internet and through social media. So we do have the power. In the words of Alice Walker, biggest way people give up power is by not knowing we have it to start with. We do have it, and you know, we don't need to rely on the corporate media to cover us.
I'm really fascinated by your take on the fundamental structure of American democracy, and more specifically, the two-party system. Can you briefly explain to listeners, in the context of the two-party system in American politics, why you feel the philosophical concept of the lesser of two evils is applicable?
So the two-party system, we weren't always this way, but there was a big pushback in the McCarthy era, you know, against independent third parties, against the left, against communism and socialism and anything that wasn't, you know, sort of garden variety, Democrat and Republican. So there are all kinds of rules that keep small parties off the ballot, make it very difficult. We were on the ballot for about 83% of voters in the last election. We're trying to at least equal that, maybe better that this time around. But, you know, it tips the playing field against you. There are all kinds of ways that, you know, people are goaded into thinking there are only two options. Yet what's happening now, if you look at American polls, is that the majority of the public has rejected both of the parties. It's actually 21% that identify as Republican, 29% identify as Democrat, and 50% that have rejected them both. The debates, the presidential debates, are controlled by a special commission, which is actually the political parties themselves. So they write rules to lock out the largest voting bloc, which is neither Democrat nor Republican. So this two-party system is a system that is basically failing. And part of how it fails is this propaganda campaign that you have to go with the lesser evil. You can't actually vote for a candidate in a third party that represents your ideals. But actually, you know, this is really a politics of fear that tells you got to vote your fears and not your beliefs. And the reality is that politics of fear has delivered everything we were afraid of. All the reasons that people are told they have to silence themselves and go with the lesser predator. Those are reasons like, oh, because you don't want the wars to expand, or you didn't want massive Wall Street bailouts, or you didn't want the attack on immigrants, or you didn't want the offshoring of our jobs, or the attack on our civil liberties. Well, guess what? That's exactly what we got from the lesser evil, from the Obama presidency, with two houses of Congress that were Democratic. We got an agenda that made George Bush look like a wimp. You know, his bailouts were $700 billion. Under Obama, it's reached $16 trillion, you know, and on. The free trade agreements were all passed by Democrats. The privatization of our schools, the use of high-stakes testing, these incredible predatory loans, which have just become even more predatory, has been passed under Democrats, with Democrat support and Democratic leadership. So the bottom line here is that it's time to reject the lesser evil, to forget the lesser evil. We've got to stand up and fight for the greater good. Lesser evil is a propaganda campaign. We need to stand up and be the moral compass that democracy must have if we are to move forward. And remember, we have the numbers it takes. 43 million young people are locked into debt. Young people and not so young are locked into debt with no way to get out of it in an economy for the foreseeable future that does not provide the jobs to get out of debt. 43 million, And there's only one campaign that will cancel the debt. That's our campaign. Even Bernie Sanders will not talk about canceling student debt. So if that word gets out, and we can conduct the the guerrilla media campaign about that, 43 million is enough to win a three-way race. And this is likely to be a four or a five-way race right now. So the old propaganda no longer applies. The vote is going to be divided up all over the place. And it's really important for people not to be intimidated out of our power. We can change our direction. We can actually win this election in all kinds of ways, but we could even win it numerically by simply bringing out young people who are locked into debt to come out on November 8th and vote green to cancel your debt. You have the numbers to actually make that happen and transform our future.
So now we know your perception of the Democrats as being nothing more than a party that is just a small bit more progressive than the GOP. I have to ask you about Bernie Sanders. Sanders shares many policy positions and values which you believe in. Now, I'm sure that you'd say he doesn't go far enough on many issues, but he voted against the Iraq war. He wants to increase the minimum wage from $7.25 to $15 an hour. He wants to make college tuition fee free, and there are also many other examples of progressive policies of his as well. Is a candidate like Sanders running as a Democrat really part of the problem, and from a consequentialist philosophical perspective, the lesser of two evils, or do you think he deserves a little more credit than that?
I do think he deserves more credit than that, and we have a lot in common with his domestic policies, but the real question here is, how long will a revolutionary campaign be tolerated by a counter-revolutionary party? So many people regard us as Plan B, as Plan B for the Sanders campaign, when in the high likelihood that the Democrats marginalize him, because the Democrats have a very consistent record for basically sabotaging true rebels in their own ranks. And, from Jesse Jackson, who had won 12 major primaries in Midwestern states, and they sabotaged him with a public relations campaign that dragged him down as supposedly being anti-Semitic, to Dennis Kucinich, who they redistricted and basically got him out of office altogether, wouldn't allow him in the debates, to Howard Dean, and they ran a public smear campaign, the so-called Dean Scream, which made him out to be a madman and filled the airwaves with, a moment of bad video that he was the victim of. So the Democrats have a history, and I should add, in addition, they have the Super Tuesday, which makes it very hard to actually run effective primaries in 10, 15 or more states on one day. So that's going to be a real challenge to the Sanders campaign. Unlike Hillary, who's run before, she's got a real machine that can do this, as well as a lot of money and super PACs that Bernie doesn't have. And then they have super delegates, which are, already being rounded up by Bill Clinton. There are something like two members of Congress, I think, that support Bernie. And, there are like 150 members in the House that support that are supporting Hillary. So this is the question, is the party going to be tolerated? But beyond that, just if I can say a word about the agenda, the best that the Democratic Party could do right now, and this is under the policies that Bernie's advocating, you still have a military budget that's bankrupting us financially and morally. You still have a war on terror that's creating more terror. You have a Federal Reserve that they want to audit when it should be nationalized. They support all the Democrats, even the progressive Democrats, voted against the amendments to the No Child Left Behind Act. They voted against the amendments that would have reduced school privatization, that would have given an opt-out option so that young people didn't have to be brutalized by high-stakes testing. So you still have a privatized and abusive public school system, which is abusing our teachers and undermining unions. You still have the enslavement of a generation to predatory student debt. And you still have a military-industrial security complex that's dictating foreign policy. And you still have heroes like Edward Snowden, who will be treated like criminals rather than the heroes that these whistleblowers should be. And you still have support for the human rights abuses and war crimes being committed by Saudi Arabia and Israel and Egypt. So whether you regard our campaign as plan B or as plan A, you know, we need to keep the pressure on. We need to keep the heat on for a world that works for all of us. We're not going to get there under the political parties sponsored by the war profiteers and the fossil fuel giants and the predatory banks.
It seems to me, while you have your doubts, when compared to your views on candidates such as Hillary Clinton, you're quite favourable towards Sanders. With this in mind, and I know the scepticism that you feel about Bernie's actual chances, but we recently wrote about Sanders' VP choices on Political People blog and predicted that he might actually pick Elizabeth Warren if he was to win the nomination. Others, however, took a more strategic position, and they said that Warren is needed in the Senate and that Dr. Jill Stein would be the perfect person for the role of vice president as part of a progressive revolution. Is that something you would ever consider?
I think we need an independent political party. We've been trying to have a dialogue with Bernie Sanders for quite some time, and we have not yet succeeded in establishing that line of communication, but I think it would be a very fruitful one. And an equal question to ask is, what will Bernie Sanders do? I know he's already said he's going to endorse Hillary Clinton if and when, in the likelihood that he gets knocked out. You know, I'd say there's a question on his side, too. Is he just going to go quietly into that dark night? And if so, his supporters are going to need a place to go. In terms of, you know, would I accept a place in a Sanders administration? Well, you know, there are Greens who work in the EU, certainly, in, you know, other administrations. That happens all the time. And that is certainly something that could be discussed. Would I abandon the need for independent politics? I don't think so, because, you know, we need an independent political movement that's not trapped by corporate money. And that independent political movement needs a political voice that is not hamstrung by corporations. But I think there's a lot of room for dialogue here. And, you know, the future may be wild. So hold on to your hat and let's see what happens. I think it'd be wonderful if we could establish a line of communication with Bernie Sanders.
So far during this election cycle, we've seen a huge amount of anti-establishment sentiment manifest itself on the right wing in the form of the success of candidates such as Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. However, you, a candidate such as you, are much better placed, in actual fact, to utilise upon this anti-establishment sentiment and hopefully bring about the collapse of this two-party system. How do you plan to encapsulate and profit from this real cynicism people have with politics as usual?
Yes, it's enormous, you know, and it's captured in that 50% that have basically divorced themselves from the parties. We saw it in 2014 in the midterms when almost two-thirds of voters stayed home, 80% of young people. So, you know, let me say sort of one overarching comment, and then I'll make a couple particular points. The overarching is that history works in wondrous ways, and you don't know where the openings will happen. In the words of Woody Allen, half of life is showing up. You know, so we want to be a political force. We want to go on record. We want to put that agenda out there and work in all ways possible to get the word out. You know, and it's wonderful that you over there, you know, in Dublin are actually helping to lift up the voice of this campaign among young people who are so networked across national boundaries around the world, you know, so that will reverberate back inside the U.S. So we don't know how this is going to happen. When the wall came down in East Germany, Chris Hedges, the renowned reporter formerly with the New York Times, reports how that very week democracy community was meeting, thinking, oh, maybe in 10 years they would get somewhere. And then suddenly, you know, the huge crowds came out and the wall came down. So you don't know where the system is going to first begin its all-out collapse. But right now it's like a house that's been eaten out by termites. And that collapse is going to happen. So it's very important that we be here with as much experience as possible and be shouting out and standing up as loud and strong as we can so that people know there is another way forward and that we move in the right direction as the openings occur. Now, that said, we have these two lawsuits. We're suing the Commission on Presidential Debates to do everything we can to open up this mockery of democracy that takes place that we call the commission, presidential debates. We're trying to open them up because 50% of voters are currently locked out. So we'll be trying to get in there. We encourage people to go to our website, jill2016.com, because we will, we'll be conducting direct action campaigns, economic boycotts, etc. We are hoping to get that organized in the next few weeks or months to begin this action early to try to pressure the debates to opening up. We'll be growing our communications in all kinds of ways. We've just qualified for federal matching funds, so we are only beginning to staff up right now. And again, I encourage young people to go to our website. If you are in the jobs market now, we're beginning to hire. So look at our jobs page, and also our volunteer page. Get involved if you can, because it is the young people, the younger generation, who always creates, who's always the engine for transformational change, and we want to help you do that in this election.
People often comment upon the issue of electability. Would you agree that it is a case of the more people hear about Dr. Jill Stein, the more they like her, and therefore the more media attention and debates you get to go to, the more your electability increases, and so does the viability of your candidacy?
Absolutely. And this is partly what transformed my view of politics. Mm-hmm. I got involved very late on. I got involved as a medical doctor, very frustrated with this epidemic of asthma, cancers, learning disabilities, autism, diabetes, et cetera, that was descending, especially on young people. And I realized our genes didn't change overnight. There was something going on in the environment. So I came to politics at the ripe young age of 50. I only began to be, involved in political discourse because I just didn't trust it. But everything else was failing. I had become an activist. I was working to change laws and regulations, and thought that, we were building these huge coalitions, but it didn't make a bit of difference. The bottom line was whether you had money to buy off your politicians. So at any rate, I got tricked into running for office, having no idea what I was getting into. I ran for governor against Mitt Romney in 2002, and we fought our way into this televised election and televised debate. Inside the debate, our agenda for cutting the military, putting our dollars into real security at home, health and education as human rights, for greening our energy and our economy. Those ideas went over like lead balloons inside the TV studio. But when we emerged from the studio to the waiting press, I was mobbed by the press for the first time and the last time, and they told me that I had won the debate on the instant online viewer poll. So suddenly the light went on in my brain, and I realized, oh my God, this is all just a scam. We are told that we're marginal because they are terrified that we should get heard, because as we get heard, we are going to win the day here. We actually do have the numbers to do it, and we have already won in the court of public opinion. We don't have to change people's minds. We just have to let them know that there is a credible way forward, and that there are compelling solutions that we can put to work right now for us, we the people. And, at that point, I was not only taken out of that debate, I was prohibited from entering any other debates. I was much too dangerous an entity, and these ideas were far too powerful. And this is generally the experience of informed Greens and socialists whenever we get into the public discussion. And there is this wonderful coalition that's been developing in the UK, as in definitely in the U.S. and other countries around the world. Under the Green banner, we really have socialists and Greens coming together to build an agenda and to build an unstoppable force for people, planet, and peace over profit. In the words of Alice Walker, the biggest way people give up power is by not realizing we have it to start with. And we do indeed. And, we are indeed electable. Our job I used to think we had to persuade people and change their minds. We don't have to do that. History has done that for us. All we have to do is get the game plan together and get the tactics together and the strategies so that we can actually do an end run around the corporate media and the corporate political parties that are trying to suppress us to actually build on this tsunami of power, which is surging. This genie is not going to go back into the bottle. This is the time to get involved. Make it happen. Let's take back our future while we can still make it right.
It's very interesting that you mentioned your political past there, because lots of people reference Sanders his consistency on the issues as the reason why they support him. However, when people actually check it out, you are one of the most consistent principled politicians in all of America. And as a result, in 2012, you received over 450,000 votes. If I'm right, I think it's more than any female presidential candidate in American history. Were there any evident issues or lessons associated with that campaign that you've highlighted and make you feel a stronger, better candidate this time around?
Absolutely. You know, I had been recruited to run for national office, not really focused on national or international issues very much. So 2012 was really a learning experience for me, and it was kind of a trial by fire, where I had to come up to speed very quickly on national and international issues. I had been very much focused at the community level and at the state level. And, you know, I sort of allowed my arm to be twisted, and I jumped into that campaign. And, you know, I think we were really validated. And I think we've been validated by history. We've been absolutely right about our positions on climate, on equal marriage, on LGBT rights, on transgender rights, on, you know, on healthcare as a human right. We've been absolutely right. And people who voted for us were absolutely vindicated here, you know, and lit up by history as really the trailblazers. So it's enabled me, I think, not only to see that we were right, but also to see that, you know, and we were right on student debt and the need for public higher education for free, which we really went to bat on 4 years ago when nobody else was, you know, mentioning it at all. It was a leading issue for us. So, you know, we've been ahead of the curve, and the curve has caught up to us. And furthermore, it really showed me that the rebellion is in full swing. It's out there and it's happening, you know, not only on, you know, for student debt, but on Black Lives Matter, on ending racial violence and racism that's just hardwired not only into policing and the prison system, but also into our economy and our schools and our health and all that. So, you know, the energy is really out there. Second time around, it's just, you know, it's so exciting and exhilarating to, you know, to sort of sit back and relax and just enjoy the ride. I feel like we are surfing on a tsunami right now. we're sort of a surfboard on a tsunami, and we're getting the word out, you know, for others to join us and to really harness this wave for the social transformation whose time has come and that needs a political party as a part of this social revolution. We need truly a political revolution with a party that supports it. And, you know, however far we get, this is all for the good, and we are going to keep building from here.
And finally, Jill, one of the main reasons we established the Political People podcast and Political People blog is that we really wanted to expose inspiring, innovative, progressive candidates such as yourself. So there are sure to be lots of people listening today truly inspired by the words that you have said today, the policies which you advocate. How can they get involved and unify and mobilize under a new green progressive banner?
Wonderful. So, you know, if you are in the U.S. or you're a U.S. citizen living abroad, you know, get involved with our campaign, because we really, you know, we are lifting up the voices of young people and the vision of young people to take over this election, you know, and millennials actually have the power to do that and the numbers to do that, you know, and we're here to basically lift you up and bolster you, because your vision needs to be the new paradigm. It shouldn't just be allowed, you know, it needs to take over. And You know, we're here to get that word out and to help you get the word out, and you can help us get the word out. We want to organize chapters, Young Greens Rising chapters, in colleges and universities and technical schools, and in high schools as well. Not only because seniors are beginning to vote, but because these are the voters of the future. They have brothers and sisters and parents who vote. So we really, you know, we really look to young people to be the leaders of this. And in other countries, you know, get involved with your green parties, because there are wonderful things happening and we are working together. We're hoping to build an international coalition for a peace offensive. I've actually been to talk with Caroline Lucas about this, as well as with Jeremy Corbyn and other leaders. Had the opportunity actually to present this to Putin at a conference in Russia as well. And they were really quite perplexed with how much they agreed with us on many of the background issues here. So there's enormous potential for us, you know, to build this unstoppable force across generations and across national boundaries, to be a real force for people, planet, and peace over profit, and to create a world that works for all of us. You know, an America, we need an America that works for all of us in America, but we can't stop there. There's no way this is going to work for America while the rest of the world is being exploited and crushed and preyed upon. This needs to be a world that works for all of us. So please get involved with your local Green Party, with your state Green, your national Green Party, if you're not in the U.S. And here, please get involved with our campaign at jill2016.com. And the future is ours to take back.
Well, as you mentioned, Jill, Jeremy Corbyn was successful in his Labour leadership election in the UK. Caroline Lucas managed to be elected a Member of Parliament in the UK, and we wish you the best of luck as well. Anyone who wants to check out Jill can do so at jill2016.com, her Facebook page, Jill Stein, and also her Twitter at Dr. Jill Stein. Jill, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Adam. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. All the best, and I hope to stay in touch as we go forward.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.